Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments.
Today, we're tackling a question that's so fundamental, it almost feels, well, unthinkable. What if the shot heard round the world was never fired? What if the Declaration of Independence remained just a philosophical exercise in a dusty drawer somewhere?
Exactly. What if the 13 colonies never united, never rebelled, and the United States of America simply never was? It's a question that has always fascinated me personally, because so much of modern global identity is built on the foundation of that revolution.
It really is. For me, it's the cultural question. I grew up so steeped in the mythology of the Founding Fathers and the birth of this republic. The idea of peeling that away, of imagining a North America that evolved under completely different principles, perhaps as a collection of British dominions, is just, it's a mind-bending exercise.
It's more than just a different flag, isn't it? It's a different world. The American Revolution was the first domino in the great age of revolution. Without it, does the French Revolution ignite in the same way? What happens to the Spanish colonies in the Americas? The ripple effects are almost too vast to comprehend.
And that is precisely what we're going to attempt to do today. We're going to explore that unseen republic, or rather, the lack of one. We'll journey down a timeline where British America persists, and the political, social, and global landscape is altered in ways that are both profound and perhaps deeply unexpected.
So, let's start there, with the political landscape. If there's no singular violent break in 1776, what does governance in North America look like in, say, 1800? It's not a static picture. The crown can't just keep sitting on this pressure cooker. Do we see a gradual evolution towards something like a Dominion of North America, similar to what Canada later became?
I'm not so sure it would be that neat. The grievances that led to the revolution, the economic constraints, the cry of no taxation without representation, those don't just vanish. Britain would have had to do something. I wonder if instead of one big revolution, you get a series of smaller, more localized rebellions over decades. Maybe Pennsylvania erupts over one issue, while Virginia remains staunchly loyalist for another 10 years.
That's a really interesting point, because the colonies weren't a monolith. You see that even in the constitutions they wrote after declaring independence. You have Pennsylvania's radical, unicameral legislature, with universal manhood suffrage, on one end of the spectrum.
Right. And on the other, you have places like Maryland or Virginia, which immediately put in these very conservative, bicameral systems, with strong governors and significant property qualifications to even vote, let alone hold office. They were almost creating a new aristocracy.
They were absolutely trying to replicate the British system, just without the king. So if you remove the unifying force of a war against a common enemy, do those two factions, the radical Democrats and the conservative Republicans, do they ever find common cause, or do they become rivals?
Oh, I think they become rivals. Fierce rivals. Could you imagine a scenario where the crown plays them off each other? They make a deal with the Virginian planter class, granting them more local authority, maybe even some token titles, in exchange for their help in suppressing the more radical, democratic movements in Philadelphia or Boston.
That feels very plausible. A classic divide-and-conquer strategy. And it speaks to that fundamental question of identity you raised earlier. The revolution forced a sort of composite American identity into existence. Without it, you'd likely have a stronger Virginian identity, a Massachusetts identity, a Pennsylvanian one, all developing in very different directions.
And what would that mean for westward expansion? The Proclamation of 1763 was a huge source of tension. If Britain maintains control, do they hold that line at the Appalachians for much longer to manage relations with Native American tribes and control their colonial subjects? A slower, more controlled expansion, managed from London, would create a completely different American West, or no American West at all.
That idea of no American West, that's a staggering thought. It's not just a change in geography, it's a change in the entire American psyche. The concept of the frontier, of manifest destiny, of always having somewhere to go to reinvent yourself, that's baked into the identity that was created. Take that away, and what are you left with?
You're left with a pressure cooker. A much more European model, in a way. If London effectively holds that Appalachian line, maybe not forever, but for another 50 or 60 years, think about the consequences. The Crown's goal is stability. They don't want expensive wars with Native American confederacies. So they draw a hard line. They make treaties. They establish a permanent or semi-permanent Indian territory.
Which would be seen as an absolute betrayal by the colonists, especially the Virginians, the Pennsylvanians, the speculators like George Washington himself, whose wealth was tied up in Western land claims. The grievance shifts, doesn't it? It's no longer just about taxes levied from London, it's about opportunity denied from London.
Right. The narrative becomes the king is siding with the savages against his own people. And that is a powerful, dangerous motivator. It might even be more potent than the Stamp Act. Because now, it's not just about money. It's about birthright, land, and a perceived racial hierarchy.
So, the very thing Britain does to prevent a conflict ends up fueling a completely different, and maybe even uglier one. Instead of a revolution based on Enlightenment ideals of liberty, you could get a series of brutal frontier wars where the colonists are fighting not just native tribes, but also British regulars who are there to enforce the boundary.
Exactly. The Redcoats become the police force of the Proclamation Line. Imagine a young, ambitious colonial militiaman. In our timeline, he's fighting the French and their native allies, and he sees the British army as his ally. In this timeline, he might see the British soldier as the one stopping him from claiming his fortune, from protecting his settlement. The enemy is redefined.
And what does that do to the institution of slavery? The deep, deep irony is that many founding fathers, Jefferson included, thought slavery was a dying institution. They believed it would wither away. But what gave it that horrific second life was the cotton gin and the expansion into the Deep South, into Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana.
The lands that would be on the other side of that British line.
The very lands. So if that expansion is choked off, if the plantation economy is confined to the eastern seaboard, does slavery actually decline? Does the economic incentive to maintain it lessen in places like Virginia and Maryland as tobacco exhausts the soil?
That is a fascinating and deeply uncomfortable question. One possibility is, yes, it withers. The South diversifies its economy, and slavery becomes a remnant, eventually abolished by a decree from Parliament in the 1830s, just as it was in the rest of the British Empire. The colonies follow the path of the West Indies.
Which would mean no civil war, but at the cost of no United States.
But there's a darker possibility, isn't there? That without new land, the existing slave system becomes even more entrenched and brutal. The value of every enslaved person skyrockets. The planter class, feeling economically and geographically cornered by the crown, doubles down on their one source of wealth and power. It becomes a fortress society, even more paranoid and violent than it already was.
That fortress society idea is chilling, because it feels psychologically true. When a system based on an enormous profitable injustice feels threatened, it doesn't reform. It calcifies. It becomes more brutal. You'd see slave codes become even more draconian. Any hint of abolitionist sentiment from London would be treated as a foreign attack.
And think of the timeline. The abolitionist movement in Britain really picks up steam in the late 1780s and 90s. In our history, they were focused on the West Indies. In this timeline, their biggest, wealthiest, and most politically powerful target for abolition would be Virginia and the Carolinas. How does Parliament in London try to impose its will on a powerful, armed, and utterly defiant colonial gentry thousands of miles away?
They can't. Not easily. So you get this incredible world-turned-upside-down scenario where the descendants of the would-be revolutionaries of 1776, maybe around 1820 or 1830, become the arch-conservatives, the staunchest defenders of their peculiar institution, against what they see as metropolitan tyranny.
The great irony. The cause for a potential rebellion shifts entirely. It's no longer about liberty in the Enlightenment sense. It's a rebellion to preserve slavery against an emancipating empire.
Could you imagine a declaration of secession from the British Empire, written by, say, John C. Calhoun's father or grandfather, arguing for the right to maintain slavery? It's a horrifying thought.
It is. And it changes everything on the world stage. Let's pull the camera back a bit. The late 18th, early 19th century. What's the big global event? Napoleon.
Right. The Napoleonic Wars. In our timeline, the young United States was a troublesome neutral party for Britain. The constant impressment of American sailors, the trade disputes, it all culminates in the War of 1812, which was a major costly distraction for Britain while they were fighting for their lives against the French.
But in this timeline, there is no United States. There is British North America. There's no neutral trading partner to harass. The ports of Boston, New York, Philadelphia. They are Royal Navy bases. The vast timber reserves of New England are not just available. They are crown property, building an even more powerful Royal Navy.
Oh, wow. The sheer material advantage is staggering. The hemp for ropes, the tar, the masts. Britain's naval supremacy becomes almost absolute. Does Napoleon even stand a chance against that? Does the war end sooner?
That's one way to look at it. Britain is undeniably stronger. But here's a counterthought. Are they? Or is the crown now forced to station, say, 30,000 troops, not to fight the French, but to police the proclamation line and keep an eye on their increasingly resentful southern colonies?
So, the internal security problem you mentioned earlier actually weakens them externally. Their resources are stretched thin managing their own empire, preventing it from boiling over.
It could. And what about the biggest real estate deal in history, the Louisiana Purchase? In 1803, Napoleon sells a vast swath of North America to Jefferson's government because he needs cash for his wars and he can't defend the territory. But there is no Jefferson. There is no U.S. government to sell it to.
So, what does he do with it? Just keep it? Does he try to rebuild a French empire in North America, right on the border of British territory? That seems incredibly dangerous for him.
Maybe. Or maybe he sells it to someone else. Spain? Or does he use it as a bargaining chip with London? I'll give you New Orleans if you recognize my conquests in Europe. The entire shape of the continent is now on the negotiating table.
And that completely recontextualizes the Napoleonic Wars. Suddenly, North America isn't a sideshow or a logistical problem for Britain. It's a core asset and potentially the grand prize on a global negotiating table.
It ceases to be its own story. Its fate is decided in Paris or London or at the Congress of Vienna, based on the needs of European empires. The entire trajectory of the continent is no longer driven by internal pressures, but by external horse trading.
Which, I think, brings us full circle to that question of identity. When we try to weigh this alternate timeline, it feels like the central trade-off is autonomy for stability.
Is it stability, though? I keep wrestling with that. We've mapped out a world with no U.S. civil war, which is a staggering thing to remove from history. But in its place, we've inserted decades, maybe a century, of simmering, low-grade conflict. Colonists versus redcoats on the frontier. A powerful southern gentry versus an abolitionist parliament. It's not one big war. It's a death by a thousand cuts.
I see what you mean. It's the difference between a clean catastrophic break and a chronic incurable illness. And I have to say, for all the deep agonizing flaws of the American experiment, the framework it created at least allowed for that violent break to happen and for something new to be built afterward. I'm not sure this patchwork of resentful British dominions ever gets that chance. It feels permanently stuck.
See, and I wonder if that's my modern bias showing, but I find myself leaning the other way. I look at the sheer violence of westward expansion, the Trail of Tears, the Civil War, and I see a world where a slower, more managed imperial approach might have led to, well, to less bloodshed. A less dynamic world, certainly. A less innovative one, perhaps. But maybe a more humane one for the people who are crushed under the wheels of manifest destiny.
That's a really challenging thought. That the absence of liberty, as the founders defined it, might have resulted in a better outcome for more people. It's not an easy thing to sit with.
It isn't. And we'll never know. We're left with this ghost of a world. A British North America. Powerful and populous. Entering the 20th century. What does it do in 1914? What does the world look like without the United States as a cultural, economic, and military giant in the last 100 years?
The ripple effects just become infinite. It's a completely different planet. It underscores how profoundly that one moment, that decision to rebel, shaped not just a nation, but the very definition of the modern era.
And the fact that it so easily could have gone the other way, that the world we know was never inevitable. That's the thought that's going to stick with me. It's all just a series of choices and accidents. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.